Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy. An associate professor of history at Smith College, Elizabeth Storter Pryor specializes in history and race in the United States in the 19th century. Pryor's work includes her first book, Colored Travelers, Mobility and the Fight for Citizenship Before the Civil War, a history of Black activists before Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott, and an academic article, The Etymology of the N-Word, Resistance, Language, and the Politics of Freedom in the Antebellum North. An award-winning writer and teacher, Pryor teaches college and high school students and conducts workshops for teachers on the N-word. She's also the daughter of the iconic comedian Richard Pryor. Elizabeth Storter Pryor, thank you for coming in to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've written about and taught on topics that many people would find very difficult and would probably be happy to never discuss them. What got you interested in researching and writing about the history of race in the United States?
Well, I write about the history of race, I think, because I am African American. I'm actually biracial. My mother was Jewish and my father was African American. And the fact of my racial identity sort of dictated my life experience. And I always felt like at the same time going to white schools and having this very Jewish family, I was also outside of it. So there was this urge to kind of find out more about myself, I think, initially. I studied literature in college, and I actually started in graduate school studying Black women's literature. But there was something about history and the way those stories hadn't really been unlocked for a general audience that fascinated me. And that's what got me eager to study the 19th century and race there.
What role did your parents have in your interest?
Well, I don't know that my parents had a very huge interest. It was funny. My father kind of vacillated between thinking going to college was just, you know, being an educated fool, you know, like kind of had that idea. He didn't really understand. He didn't have that urgency. My mom always had an urgency for college, but not that much interest in what I was interested in. So for her, college was sort of like just a prize, but not something that, like, nothing really happened there besides going to college and getting the college degree. Like, she didn't really understand the experience. And, you know, and so being a first generation college student, I sort of had to figure that out by myself.
You must have had some sense of that before you even went, and your interest in it that kind of drove you to learn more.
I don't know if when I went to college I had an interest in studying race, and I really didn't. I took this course that was amazing when I was an undergraduate at Tufts University, and it was called Race Awareness in America. And at the time that I took it, I was dating a white Jewish guy from New Rochelle, New York. And my argument in the class, that the teacher would say, his name was Jim Vance, he was amazing, and he used to say, there's a war going on, people, what side are you on? And the white students refused to accept that there was a war going on. They were like, are you kidding? My parents would have no problem my bringing somebody Black home. You know, this is what they were saying. And all the Black students totally understood. And I was trying to make an argument that I was in between and that me and this guy were in our own category, different than the white-Black category. And it's funny, I took the course twice.
Wow.
The first time I was absolutely in this third category. And there must have been something that unlocked awakening, because when I took it again my senior year of college, I was definitely in the Black camp. I really had come to understand my own racial identity in a new way. And I think part of that from that course, but also the kinds of experiences I had in college.
And is that also part of what got you interested in focusing on the language in particular, including the use of the so-called the N-word?
Well, you know, the N-word really, I didn't know this before I started doing the work, but in retrospect, the N-word is definitely, it tells my life story. The first intellectual, and actually the first conversation I ever had with my father, but really was also an intellectual conversation. I was 6 years old. And he sat me down, and I think my mother had told him that I'd been called the N-word on the schoolyard. And he sat me down, and he was like, don't ever let anybody call you that. And gave me a whole explanation about my responsibility. I mean, I'm like in pigtails with those little bobs on my, you know, those little clicky bobs
right
on my pigtails. And he's sitting there and telling me that I have a responsibility as a Black person in the United States to fight back when I'm called the N-word. Yeah.
Do you remember how you felt?
Yes. I felt that it was really unfair. And I loved sharing this special secret. Like, I loved that it was like something that only my dad could tell me, that my mom wasn't really in the conversation, right? That she had to sit on the outside. But I also, the sense of responsibility was overwhelming. And I think that stayed with me. I think it still is overwhelming a little bit.
Right. That's a pretty heavy topic to be discussing with a six-year-old.
Yeah.
In one of your papers, you write that in the 18th century, before some northern states started passing abolition laws, that the N-word and slave were interchangeable words, but that began to change as the abolitionist movement picked up steam, and the N-word became even more hateful and carried more meaning.
Yeah, and I think that's actually not just my argument, but an argument that all historians have made about the N-word. But the intervention that I make, what made the N-word interesting for me, and you know, I can talk a little bit about why I specifically became interested and when about the N-word, but I'll say this for now. What I think I brought differently was I wasn't just interested in the word as a weapon of white anti-Black violence, but I was interested in the question of why did Black people use a word that was meant to subjugate them? And when did they start doing that? And how did that work? And I think asking that question changed and pivoted my whole perspective. And I think the evidence bears out really the whole story about how the N-word became as violent as it is. Why the word that we are saying with an initial right now is the N-word instead of a lot of other words like Black or African or colored or all sable, darky. There's all these words that aren't even necessarily nice words, but are words that we can say right now over the radio. But there's something particular and a particular history around the N-word, I think, that is centered actually in Black subversion and protest. And that's why that word in particular carries the weight that it does.
When did you become interested in that? What got you hooked?
Well, I was teaching my second semester at Smith College, where I teach a course that I have had a lot of trouble with and don't teach anymore, called The Age of the Civil War, or something like this. And I had a white student who would always sit in the front row and who was always so kind and supportive. I mean, really, it's scary being in your second semester teaching. Teaching is rough. But this student always had their hands up and was always super supportive. And I was talking about the ideas of inclusion and exclusion in American identity kind of broadly. And I was given the example of an African-American correspondent in the 1850s to the Frederick Douglass newspaper and how he spoke about Chinese people using a lot of the same kind of verbiage that stereotypes that you would imagine being used against Black people by whites. And I was kind of making the points that, like, white people don't own, you know, prejudice, like that this is actually a bigger issue about power and identity and, you know, nationalism and all these kinds of things. So I'm trying to make this point, and the student stopped me, and forever the line will kind of chase me around. I hope the student hears this one day. But they said, they raised their hand, interrupted the lecture, and I always let my students do this. And they said, "Have you seen Blazing Saddles?" I was like, and so, you know, like you, I was like, huh.
Right, not quite sure what to say to that.
Right. And I was like, yes, I have seen Blazing Saddles. Now, the complication for me in that moment was that my father co-wrote Blazing Saddles. And so I wasn't sure what the student was trying to get at in that moment. And they were like, so I was like, yes, I have. And then I turned back to the lecture. And they said, no. It's a line from Blazing Saddles. And they repeated a line that had the N-word in it, and a disparaging word for people of Chinese descent, but they said the actual words. And so it was at that moment where two things happened. One is I started to realize nobody had ever taught me how to teach this and how to deal with this kind of moment in my classroom. This had never come up in any of the classes I'd taken preparing for exactly the job that I'm doing. And oh no, because I could feel the temperature drop. And the other question, as I thought and reflected on that moment, was, do I even know what this word really means? And does it mean the same thing in the early 19th century that it means right now?
And so that got you interested in doing all the research that you've done on the topic and written a paper about it, and you're looking at writing a book about it as well?
I am. I started having these conversations with students, and I thought the conversation was going to be very, like, freedom of speechy. Right?
Right.
And so, like, it was going to be a debate. For or against, do we say the N-word in the classroom? When I had the very first discussion, and subsequently with everybody that I've ever had this discussion with, they want to tell me their stories. And literally almost every one of my students, no matter their race, have a story of the N-word predominantly in the classroom. And this tremendous awkwardness, discomfort, fear, shame that comes out around that moment of not knowing how they're going to navigate around the N-word in the classroom.
In your research, what did you find? What is it about the N-word that makes it so taboo, so loaded compared with those other words?
You know, I'm actually stealing this from a colleague who said this in a conversation we were having a few weeks ago, but I think there's nothing like the N-word that can so quickly collapse the past and the present in a singular moment, right? So it's in the dusty pages of books. It's archaic. It's being shouted at Black people as they're being lynched in the 1890s and in the 1920s. It's like the soundtrack of riots. It's also right there in the classroom in real time. There are real people who are experiencing its violence in real time at that moment. And for me, the solution has been really surface, which is like to say or not to say, right? Whereas what I got from my students is this is a conversation they've never even had. What better place than the classroom to talk about this word in an academic context?
So put aside the question of like whether you can say it or whether you can't say it or have a right to say it. Put that aside and focus on what it means. I'm going to read one of the things that you've said about teaching this in a class. And you said, students are terrified. Black students are terrified that I'm not going to take care of them, that I'm going to allow white students to say whatever they need to for their intellectual process. And the white students are terrified that they're going to put their foot in their mouths in a way that they can't even predict because racism is so subtle and so deep. They're afraid that they're going to inadvertently reveal a dark thought. How do you break through that for them?
Well, I just had this conversation with my class of 40 a couple of weeks ago. And honestly, I liked it best of any that I've had because it was actually totally awkward. I think the real way to enter in these conversations is to acknowledge that they're going to be kind of awkward. One of the ways that they don't work is what one of my students called performative wokeness, right? So this is when students say what they think they're supposed to say in this conversation instead of raising the questions they really have around this and the discomfort that they really have. Instead, they say what they're supposed to say, and then that creates its own kind of awkwardness. That tends to shut people down, and the conversation can't really happen. So it was kind of exciting having one of my students who is white said, I'm not even sure if I'm even supposed to be speaking this much right now in this conversation. I mean, that's amazing. I kind of think of like conversations about race, but particularly about the N-word, as this kind of sex before sex education. Here's this moment where we can really introduce these topics, and nobody wants to say these words that are, you know, these body parts that I'm not going to say now because I'm not even sure if I can say over the radio, but nobody really wants to say these words and work them through. But, you know, then people don't know where babies come from, and then we have a problem. So they started teaching sex education, and I think race education is very much the same. Like, kids need to learn how to get the vocabulary to have these conversations.
To make it so it isn't taboo. I imagine for your students that it's probably a relief for them to know that their anxieties are normal and that it's okay to feel that way, but they should kind of plunge forward anyway.
Right. I mean, I think everybody should probably realize that, you know, what I say about the N-word is that it's a leaky word. And I think this is part of what you just quoted, but it's a word that makes us reveal things about ourselves that we don't even mean to reveal. So the very fact that I'm a Black person who says the surrogate phrase, the N-word, is telling you something about me, because there are a lot of Black people out there who use the word, right? And would be in a different position around the word. So it tells stuff about ourselves that maybe we don't even want to reveal yet. You know, my students are sort of grappling with this, and so am I.
And you said your students all have stories? I guess I found that a little bit surprising.
I did an exercise recently in a workshop. So I conduct workshops with secondary school teachers and sometimes with the college faculty. And I tried a new exercise where I said, do a free write where you imagine just a pivotal N-word moment that you can reflect on, what happened in this moment? Now, it could be your own moment. It could be something you witnessed. You know, there's all these, you know, array of possibilities. There wasn't one person around the table who wasn't able to enter that conversation. And so I really do believe that we all do. If you live in the United States, I mean, this is the great verbal symbol of U.S. racism. I mean, we all have a relationship to it. We've all made a decision. Do I say it? Do I not say it? Do I say it in private and not in public? Do I sing along? Do I not sing along? I think it's rare when somebody doesn't have that relationship.
And you made the decision that you do not say it. Was there a specific point when you made that decision?
I've actually been making the decision increasingly over time, even now in writing the book that you mentioned, which is that I am writing a book about the N-word in historical and pedagogical context framed by my experience as a biracial woman and also my father's daughter, my father, Richard Pryor. But the first time was in 2008, and I was giving a talk at a conference, and I asked a very close African-American colleague about the paper, and I said, what do I do? I've got the N-word a couple of times in here. And they were like, I never say it. I never say it in that public context. And I was like, oh, I don't have to say it? Like, that was news to me.
So you were thinking maybe it was in your paper, so you're going to have to say it.
I'm going to have to say it. And that was really an amazing moment for me. And at the time, I was still saying the word often. Like, if I told a story and it was my husband, who's white, who was like, stop, don't, no, you know, but I would just be like, we're home alone. Like, who cares?
Because it would make him uncomfortable?
It would make him really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And it's the first time I really thought, like, oh, well, why is he making such a big deal about this? But I was uncomfortable, too. I just was pretending like I wasn't.
Oh, right. Interesting. Because yeah. I think I read, did you say that as when you were growing up, you were felt uncomfortable with it? Because as you said, you were kind of in the middle.
I don't know if I was uncomfortable with it because I was in the middle, because I've spoken to black students and black folks from all kinds of backgrounds, and there is not a singular, I think it's not just like black people can say it and white people can't, but every black person I know has a different sort of position around it, even within themselves. Like, so maybe they'll say it sometimes, but not in other times, or they used to say it and they don't say it anymore. So it's super complex even within the individual, not even in this telling this broader story. I say often that, you know, the N-word speaks to this national trauma, but it also speaks to a really personal racial trauma that we all bear in the United States.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. We're talking with Elizabeth Storter Pryor, a professor of history and author of The Etymology of the N-Word, Resistance, Language, and the Politics of Freedom in the Antebellum North. You've said that your father, Richard Pryor, used the word in a way that was subversive and defiant. How so?
What I love about what my father did was that he sort of pulled back the veil about what black people were doing, or at least working class black people were doing in their homes around this word. He redefined who an N-word was and what an N-word could do. Right. So one of my favorite lines is at the beginning of his really important album, That N-Word's Crazy, that came out in 1974. And it's really early and he's kind of teasing and going back and forth with the audience. The audience is a little rowdy. He's kind of, you know, working through them. And then he pauses and he says, N-words never get burnt up in buildings, he said. They know how to get out of an MF situation. To me, no longer is the N-word the victim of white oppression. Clever, funny, witty, subversive. Like, this is a different thing.
Redefining it.
Right. Than the person oppressed by white violence. Even though it's still the same person, right? But it's like he's, you know, you were referencing my historical work earlier. Like black people in the 1780s and 1790s, my father imbued the N-word with meaning, or even better said, he showed the way that black people imbued it with meaning. I think he was just revealing what happened behind closed doors. You know, black people were too respectable at that point to show this part of themselves. And he was like, you know what? No, I'm showing it. This is who we are.
He stopped using the N-word, of course, I think it was after going to Africa in 1979, and he said he regretted using it.
Yeah. I mean, what's so interesting is that, you know, we take for granted now because of the advent of hip hop that, like, you know, having the N-word on your album cover. That N-word's crazy. And for new listeners, he didn't use the phrase the N-word, which wasn't really invented until 1985. He used the actual word, right? And this was groundbreaking for a Black person to put, like, open up, you know, the closet and say, you know, I'm going to adopt this. And then 5 years later, right, you know, he's like the N-word guy, basically. Right. And all of his albums actually have the N-word in them, subsequent albums. And he disavows it. And he has this moment. It's so beautiful. He says he's in the Nairobi Hilton and he's leaving a 3-week trip. And a voice whispers to him in his head, "Look around. What do you see?" And he said, "Oh, I see all kinds of people doing all kinds of things." And the voice says, "Do you see any?" And the voice says the actual N-word. And he says, "No," you know, kind of a revelation. And the voice tells him, "That's because there aren't any." And then he goes through this whole understanding. Like, I mean, it's so moving, actually. I've been wrong. That's about our wretchedness. That's not about this strength. Now, I don't even know if I agree with my dad, mm-hmm. right, around the word. I'm not even 100%. I think a few beautiful things happen in that. He's coming to that epiphany from the vantage point of a trip to Kenya. I mean, this is really like a diasporic moment where it takes an African-American being in the midst of all these African people that have the ability to move through space in a way that African Americans do not in the United States, to recognize that that word isn't really working for him in the same way that it had just a few weeks before. And then he goes on and says, "I'm not telling anybody what to do." So you might note that a lot of these Black celebrities who kind of come out and speak out against the N-word, Bill Cosby and these kind of people, like, they were dictating. They were like, "This is what people should not be doing." He said, "I don't really, you do what you want to do, but this is for me. This is like my spiritual journey. This is not working for me." I think it's powerful stuff.
What do you think of musicians, comedians who use the word today?
Well, I mean, if my argument is right, I think that Black people are using this word in response to a very real problem of equity and violence and white supremacy. And so I've heard a lot of people say that this problem will be solved if Black artists stop using the N-word, because the reason why the N-word is so popular, it's so popular in our culture today, is centers on Black artists using it, their music, etc.
And if we eliminate that, that'll just take care
of
the problem.
If we eliminate that, then the problem will be over. And really, I think the question is the wrong question. The question is, why is this word working for Black people? It is working for Black people. It's working so well for Black people that a bunch of white people want to use it too.
Right.
Right. And until the conditions are remedied that make it possible for that word to have meaning for Black people, I have no problem with Black people using it in the way that they do in their music and their art and their politics.
So you're saying they're tapping into something that anxiety, that sentiment in our society, it's there.
Right. Well, I mean, I think just like in the 1780s and 1790s, that the word was a response. It originally meant, it was interchangeable, like you said, with slave, and didn't really have the meaning of a slur, but that Black people knew that they were called this, and they were like, "Yeah, call us this. We're going to call each other this. We're going to call ourselves, and we're going to have all these multifaceted meanings that we're applying it to it." That made it the source of anti-Black violence. White people didn't like the fact that Black people were using this word in the subversive way that they were. I mean, it was subversive to call each other and say, "Yeah, we're not really bothered by it in the way that you expect us to be."
Trying to own the word.
Right. We're owning it. But not my father, right? Not in the 1970s, but 200 years before. Black people, I mean, you would think in the 1930s WPA interviews with former slaves that those former slaves who had made decisions to marry, get educations, to move and do all these things, that they would just stop using the N-word, but they don't. Right? It's right all over all of their stories. They use the N-word in various ways.
Another topic that you've studied and written about is blackface, which historically has been white people blackening their face for so-called comedy that in reality is extremely demeaning. And you've said that these characters were a way of messaging, sending the message that Black freedom was a threat and very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. The N-word is discursive blackface. I mean, that's just the truth. And one of the things about the word that I always try to impress on students, students will say, will think they know about it, and they'll say, oh, it's a word from slavery. It's a word from slavery. And I was like, yes and no, because really the N-word becomes the N-word when black people start to become free. And you'll hear it most when black people start becoming prosperous. So this word really, in its life as a slur, is really used against black freedom. And I think blackface is very much the same, right? In fact, the popularity of the N-word, I argue, and many other people argue this as well, comes out of the rise of the minstrel show in the 1820s and 30s. And it's that moment when white actors are putting, you know, black makeup on their face and performing on stage as if they are actually black, that they do these certain things that kind of telegraphs their blackness, their faux blackness, but their blackness to their audiences. Raggedy clothes, the black face, dialect, and the N-word. And this is how you know the person's really black that you're seeing up on stage, right?
Because they can use that word.
They are embodying a black person. There were audiences who went to see those minstrel shows and believed they were actually seeing real, they weren't sure, was that a real black person up there, you know? But, I mean, I don't think there's a safe black face, right? I don't think there's a black face whose intention is not to diminish black freedom and black prosperity. It doesn't exist. They go hand in hand. They're working together.
How do you think people can talk about all these issues that we've been talking about and trying to bridge the divides? And I'm thinking about people who aren't in the classes that you're teaching or that other people may be teaching, but who do want to be able to talk about it and make progress.
I mean, I would say probably start reading stuff. I think reading is a really good place. And there are a lot of incidents that have happened in, you know, the last several years in particular around the N-word in the classroom and, you know, professors kind of alienating their students around them, often white professors, usually white professors. And what these professors have in common is that when students speak out and say, I'm uncomfortable, they double down. So they say, I have the right to use this, or I'm not hurting anyone, or this isn't that big of a deal, or if you can't handle it, you should leave. And I think one of the most important things that people who really want to kind of crack open the thing in themselves that doesn't really fully understand racism but kind of wants to is to stop doubling down, to like take somebody for their word. They're telling you that this moment is happening for them, to step back and have that humility and teachability and be open-hearted.
Elizabeth Storter Pryor, thank you for coming in to talk with us.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Elizabeth Storter Pryor, an associate professor of history at Smith College who specializes in 19th century United States history and race. Her work includes the book Colored Travelers, Mobility and the Fight for Citizenship Before the Civil War, and the paper The Etymology of the N-Word, Resistance, Language, and the Politics of Freedom in the Antebellum North. To hear this and other episodes of Take Note, go to wpsu.org/take note. I'm Ann Danahy, WPSU.